Good morning. So, last time we covered a bit more about I/O. We talked about how beyond just being able to access things on device controllers via the same way the processor accesses the memory, we have this communication line where we send addresses and possibly data, and possibly get back data for that address. That devices, if they're connected to that, they can also talk to memory directly, and they can take advantage of this to allow the processor to not spend time sending the data we want to send to the device that's probably being copied from memory anyways, and just tell the device, hey, I put the data in this part of memory, just get it yourself. You know that. Then we talked about FAT. So FAT had this file system, which was divided the disk into these clusters. Clusters were groups of sectors. We had this table, the file allocation table, upon which the FAT file system was named, which was a one integer per cluster. And when this cluster represented part of a file, the table entry was, where's the next thing in the cluster? And we had a special value to represent the end of files. We had these chains, this linked list of clusters that made up a file. That was the big principle of FAT. And outside of a file, this table had entries where it was zero, indicating that something was free. And this is how we use this table to also allocate new file space. We wanted to make space for a new file. We just found these zero table entries, used that space on disk. We also talked about how directories work. We learned that directories were just files, but their data, instead of being like bytes that we would read, was these directory entries, which had the name of a file and the location of that file, and also some other information about them. Then we started talking about how disks work. We just barely started talking about what cylinders, fracs, and sectors were, and about the latencies associated with them. And I'll get back to that in a bit. So first, some words on the things we talked about before. So when I talked about FAT, I missed one detail, which we'll get to later, but I'd like to mention it earlier because of the homework. So FAT keeps multiple copies of the file allocation table. And typically, these are just duplicates. This is not guaranteed. If you read the spec carefully, there are cases where that might not be true. And the idea of doing this, that we'll talk about later when we talk about reliability more generally, is that, well, part of the disk can fail. That when disks fail, one of the ways they fail is that you try to read from part of it and it just says, nope, don't got data there. And if that was where the FAT was, this would be really annoying because we couldn't figure out where any of the files were. So the extra copy is a backup copy. And this is a common thing you'll see file systems do for things like the FAT, which are just very important data structures where you just don't know what any data is at all elsewhere on the disk without them. They'll keep multiple copies of them, assuming that part of the disk might break. Also, a brief logistical note. I moved the FAT due dates to Mondays, just to give people who are finishing up paging extra time, because I don't really care about the difference between the Friday before Thanksgiving or the Monday before Thanksgiving. Also, I've set the schedule so the final assignment is due on the last day of classes, the Friday of the last day of classes. But the normal late policy will not apply to that assignment. I will not accept submissions after the final exam unless you've made arrangements with me in advance, because I need to grade things. And in theory, I'm supposed to have things graded like 48 hours after the final. So obviously I can't accept submissions 72 hours after the final, for example. So just a note for the future. So there was an anonymous feedback question asking, well, you talked about DMA. What happens when devices don't support DMA? And this might be a confusion about what DMA is, since there's this thing that we have devices connected to the memory bus, but they aren't accessing memory. So You know, devices are still usually connected to the CPU via usually the same bus that memory is connected to the CPU, not necessarily, but like that's separate from supporting DMA or not, is that they're connected to the CPU somehow. And the CPU still, regardless of whether we have DMA, reads and writes these things over this communication line to the device controller. The difference is what the CPU reads and writes and what the device controller does for itself. So without DMA, this is how we send everything to the device and receive everything from the device. If we have data that's sent to the device, we'll do it via the CPU sending it directly to the device over this line. If we want to receive data from the device, the CPU is going to retrieve it directly from the device over this line. And also the status of the device, like am I still waiting for inputs? Am I done? And commands will be sent this way. With DMA, we still send the status information, like is this disk done reading? And commands like display this on the screen, but data would be transferred by the device going to memory directly without getting the CPU involved. So any questions on this? Okay, so last time we were talking about hard drives. So I mentioned that we have in our hard drives, we have these groups of platters, and we'll call a little segment of these platters that the disk head can be spinning over, or not spinning over, the platters can be spinning with the disk head lying over a cylinder, and each platter's part of this is called a track, and this is divided into little segments we'll call sectors. And the sectors are where a chunk of data is stored that the CPU can read together. And we have different types of times associated with this because of how it works physically as far as how long does it take us to read a sector. So the first thing we need to do when reading a sector is we need to move these disk heads to lie over the correct cylinder. And that takes some time because these are physical things which don't move instantaneously. And typical time is like 5 to 10 seconds if you're going like from one end of the disk to the other. We also have rotational latency, which is, well, we've gotten over the right cylinder, but maybe I want this and the disk is spinning in this direction. I need to wait for it to go all the way around. And the typical time if we need to go most of the way around is 2 to 8 milliseconds to get to the right part of the track. The right sector on the track. And this depends on the disk. You can have disks which rotate faster, but that has the disadvantage that they're noisier and use more power. It might break more often, but that will lower that rotational latency. And once we do that, we have the transfer time, which I've given not in units of sort of time, but in megabytes per second, which is once we're at the right place, how fast can we just get the data, whatever's under the disk head? And that varies between disks, again, depending on how tightly packed the data is and how fast they're spinning, but it's like 50 to 100 megabytes a second is a typical normal range. So these are some of the big contributors to latency. There's a few others that might come up. So one that's probably the most important here is this queue time. So how long our read or write waits in line. So if we have lots of sectors to read, we are going to have to order them in some way. And you know, if the disk head has to sit over the outside of the disk to read one sector, it doesn't matter how fast we can move it into the inside if we have to wait for that to finish. And also there's some processing time involved as far as sending the messages and having the disk controller figure out exactly what to do. And disks have some interesting properties as far as this latency. And one thing is that cylinders closer to the center are faster because typically the disk does not spin at a variable speed. So the disk head is just moving over stuff more quickly there. More Okay, so talked about sort of the physical way disks work. Let's talk about the interface the OS has to disks. And the way it works is that the OS sends sector numbers. The OS says, I want to read sector number 74, 75, and 76, and 123, or something like that, and write this sector number. And these sectors are typically 512 bytes to 4K, depending on your disk. And this is how things work today. Historically, it was actually more detailed. Historically, the disks would tell you the cylinder, head, and track. You would actually, head is the which row, and track location. So head is which platter. This is not something that disks do anymore. They instead decided that we have some intelligence in the disk and we don't want to have OSs actually worry about this. So now you just get these sector numbers, and this is the same interface other things which try to look like hard drives like SSDs use. And the typical pattern is low sector numbers are closer to that nice center, and adjacent sector numbers are adjacent on disk. Or is it center? I probably did this wrong. Because it's close, if we think about this, we're moving faster over the further from the center of the disk. It's moving faster over, oh, but close, yeah. It's moving faster. Should be, I need to check that. This is what I get for just making up slides. For not, just trying to assume I remember things and not realizing. So I am not actually sure I got it right on which is closer or further from the center, but one of the sides is faster, and typically the lower sector numbers are the faster ones. And I will tell you that Thursday. A big thing though, the more important thing we actually care about is that adjacent sector numbers are adjacent on disk. And this is something the OS can take advantage of. So if you want to minimize your seek time, you want to use adjacent sector numbers for data you access together, or close by sector numbers, that they'll be arranged by the disk controller in a way which makes that work out. So if you use close by sector numbers, you don't have much rotational latency and seek time to get to the data, you know, if you're reading one then the other. So questions on that? Okay. So the disk, as I said, takes these read and write requests. So this is our commands, our read this, write this, and typically modern disk controllers will do DMA, so we'll say read this, and I'm not going to send you the data with that command, I'm just going to tell you, here's the data's in memory, get it yourself. Or if it's for write this and for read this, I'm going to tell you, don't have me read the data directly from you, just put it in this memory location, I'll figure it out when you tell me it's ready. Disk controllers typically can have a queue of pending requests. This is also something the OS can do, because you can send multiple commands and the disk controller will figure out what order to actually move the head to get there, because it knows where the disk blocks actually are, and we want to read and write multiple things, you know, in quick succession. We don't want to wait until we're done reading one thing to read the next. Quite often, if we're like reading a big file, we would just want to read all the blocks of the file that we know about. So we can just send them all, and the disk controller will read them in whatever order, you know, it decides, combined with, you know, what order we sent it the blocks to read. The US can, however, put restrictions on the disk controller, and this will be important later. So the US can, for example, most importantly, say, hey, write this, and then don't write the next thing until I'm ready, after you wrote that. And we'll see this next time when we talk about reliability. Okay, so questions on interface? Okay, so talked about hard disks. So hard disks are unreliable, depending on who you talk to. So, for example, so this is a Google study in 2007. So Google buys disks on the cheap, And they use them a lot more than you probably do. I mean, because they have all their data on these cheap disks. And they found that the annualized failure rate, so this is like the chance that a particular disk fails within any given year, was, depending on age and model of disk, between 1.7 and 8.6%. So it's probably better for your like normal laptop desktop disks because you aren't using them as much, you aren't using them in a hot server room, and you probably might not be trying to get the cheapest disks in bulk. But these are typical failure rates. And by failure, I mean the disk fails and needs to be replaced. But in addition to disk failing this way, this is the failure rate after the disk is doing a bunch of work to hide sort of partial failures. So Google found that 9% of the working disks had reallocated sectors. And what was happening there is that the disk controller noticed, oh, this part of the disk doesn't work anymore. That's too bad. I'm going to use a different part of the disk. And this is one of the reasons why disk controllers switched to just using opaque sector numbers, is that they went to do this trick where if part of the disk is broken, they'll just hide it from the OS and use some other part of the disk instead. They'll like reserve some extra space on the disk when they manufacture the hard drive to do this. And this way they can hide physical imperfections in the disk which make part of it not work. So this is called sector remapping. So part of the physical disk becomes bad. They have this little table saying, here are the bad parts of the disk, and here's the new places I put them. And this is expected behavior. You like, probably have some special data probably on the disk, maybe in something else, maybe in some sort of flash memory or something to control this. So this is dealing with failure. So you might say, okay, so they can figure out that parts of the disk are bad. How do they know this? Because if you think about what they're doing, is that they have this head which just is reading this magnetic signal, which is a signal, like there's something there, there's always data, and they need to somehow tell that the data they're getting doesn't make any sense when you can store anything on the disk. And the way this works is that the disks don't just store exactly what the OS sent. The disks use error detecting and correcting codes. So they use something like parity bits, things you can learn about if you take 44 or 34, to have extra copies of the data. So this is error detecting and correcting codes. And you can think of this as sort of extra copies, partial extra copies to detect errors and correct some errors. So they do this in order to deal with the disk media being faulty. So this can detect, correct some errors in the sense that little imperfections, which happen because they're storing things at like the micron level, typically won't make you lose data. But if you have some big enough error that they can't correct that way, they'll usually, not guaranteed, but usually, the disk controller will know, oh, this isn't consistent, this checksum is wrong, or something like that. There will be some indication that the data wasn't consistent because they have this redundancy in the actual encoding they use in the magnetic signal. And that means that the disk can tell the OS, hey, you tried to read the sector, sorry, I don't have it. And the idea is that hopefully this is better than telling the OS, hey, you tried to read that sector, here's some data, good luck, if the data is actually corrupted. And when not too many bits are damaged, the disk controller can give the OS the right data and go along its way, and in fact can rewrite that part of the disk or decide to remap it and possibly deal with part of the disk going bad, but not too bad, without the OS noticing. But if it goes too bad, the OS is just going to learn, sorry, it's not there. So this idea makes sense. So we'll use this later. This is handy for file systems because it means that we shouldn't need in our file systems to worry that much about like individual bits being flipped. That the disk is typically taking care of that for us. Okay, so I mentioned that we have queues of requests. And the queuing can happen in the controller or the OS. So the OS might send multiple commands to the disk and have multiple of them waiting, and sometime later the OS will get an interrupt that some of these finished, and the disk controller gets to decide what order do I run those in, how do I do that, or the OS might have a whole bunch of stuff it wants to read and it has to decide what order do I send this to the disk controller in. You know, if the disk controller can only process like 64 commands at a time, which ones do I send if I have more than 64? And a consideration when doing this is that you want to take advantage of adjacency. You want to do close by reads, so you want to order your queue in order to do close by reads. And this is a scheduling problem. Like with our processor scheduling, we have a queue of things to do. We need to decide what order to take things off the queue. And this has solutions which are rather different from what we saw in processor scheduling. So what is the most obvious solution, you know, given our concern, is that the disk is faster for adjacent or close by reads and writes. What's something we can do if we have a queue of requests? Which one should we do first? If, you know, based on that, what's one idea? Yeah. Yeah, so assume that, you know, we're doing lots of reads and writes, so just do the one that's closest. And this is the simplest idea, and it turns out it works very poorly, despite utilizing the disk well. And the issue is that we can have starvation. So this is known as shortest seek time first. So shortest seek time first. So this is subject to starvation. So it worked, like it's fine as far as not spending much time moving the disk head around. Great at that. But it's not fine as far as actually getting to the other side of the disk where you might want to do that read eventually. Because you can get stuck on one side of the disk if you have enough requests. So you have starvation, kind of like we saw with, you know, shortest remaining time first, that all the short jobs happen. Here, all the jobs, wherever the disk head currently is, all those reads happen, and we don't go anywhere else. So there's two common algorithms that are proposed. So one is called scan or elevator. And for this, we have our disk, and we just move or the head in towards the disk and back out. Up and down, that's the elevator idea. And whatever things are in our queue that we pass over, that we do that. So we let things pile up when we go past, let things pile up as we go back and forth. And the idea is we're just moving our head back and forth in these passes. And this is fair in the sense that, you know, we're going to get to you with, you know, roughly even intervals because the head is just moving up and down. And this does a pretty good job at minimizing our seek time without starving requests on one side of the disk or the other that we eventually will need to get to anyways. Another option is something called circular scan, which turns out to be more common. That's where we just go like outside to in or inside to out over and over again. And the reason why this is common is that some disks, my understanding is, have some fast way of resetting the disk head to the outside. So this works out better. But the idea is we just do these passes over the disk. Sometimes this is something the OS will do. I think that in modern systems, typically if there's queuing like this, it probably happens in the disk controller, just because the OS doesn't have enough requests at a time, but I'm not sure. Okay. And so one other note about disks. So disks often have a bunch of intelligence in them. So we talked about sector remapping. So their controller is not just this thing where the OS says, move the head here, give me the bits. Like, it's doing this error correcting, error detecting codes. It's doing this sector remapping. And the disk controller also often has its own cache. So this is handy because it can store red data that we might need later, just in case. You know, if the disk controller guesses you might read that part later, or if we're worried about remap sectors, we can cache the values of the sectors, even if we'd have to seek to get to them. And we can cache data that we need to write and keep it, and potentially delay the write a little bit in order to speed up our seek times, to not immediately have to seek to get rid of the data. This is great for performance. So you have 64 meg of storage on your disk controller that can hide a little bit of doing less seeking going around. It's not great for reliability because it means that we need now worry about yet another place where data could be lost. So we talked last time that you want it when you unplug your machine, that the data actually goes away from your memory if it was cached, if the OS didn't write it to disk. Now we have another version of that problem where the OS wrote it to disk, but the disk didn't manage to get it out of its cache yet. It was, just said, but the write's done, I have the data, keep going, and the disk wasn't done. The OS can learn when the disk is done, but it needs to actually try to do that. Okay, so we talked about disks, and we're gonna see how ways of taking advantage of what we saw with disks. I will overwrite center and do the fast part of the disk. So the file system can do contiguous reads and writes is the big thing. And we'll see, or nearby. And this is something we want to do in our file systems, and we'll talk about some strategies for achieving this. And an observation you might have is FAT is not very good at that. That FAT likes reading things scattered over the disk and doesn't have a particular way where we're likely to have our files, even within a file, have the data be in one place over time. And also, it would be really nice if we can figure out where to read without reading the previous thing, because we can have all these reads queued. We want to queue all the reads, let the disk or the OS figure out how to get through them all efficiently without seeking a lot. We don't want to read something from the FAT, read a block, move, seek over to the FAT again, read a block later on, back and forth. So FAT is also not a great design from that perspective. So that's, sort of the things we'll be thinking about when we're designing our file systems to take advantage of disks. And most of the file systems we're going to talk about, just because of the history, they've been designed to take advantage of these spinning hard drives. And you might say, gosh, I don't use spinning hard drives. I use SSDs or want to use SSDs. And that is true, and you want to do probably different things. And there's probably still work to be done on what should a file system look like where we're not concerned about disks, but we're concerned about SSDs. But that work, there's not really a consensus on what file systems should do about that at this point in time. And we tend to use file systems which were designed for hard drives, and SSDs, in the other direction, are designed to do things well that hard drives were doing well. So they're kind of designed to imitate hard drives in some ways, to be fast for the same file systems. So let's talk about SSDs. So this is sort of a block diagram of an SSD. So we have these storage chips, which are solid state storage. So they're you know, kind of like cache or normal memory, but they keep the data persistently, they're a bit slower, and they have one important property we'll get to as far as how you can, well, two important properties, how you can read them, which is different than normal memory. But they store the data electrically, so we don't have moving parts, we don't have to worry about moving a disk pad or rotating a disk. It means that these fail less often. And we just have a big array of these connected to a controller, which often has a CPU, often what you would call a real CPU, like a, you know, sometimes like a dual core ARM processor or something like that. Something that would make a not embarrassing phone. And some memory. So these flash chips, the way they typically work is you can read from them in what are called pages, which are kind of like sectors. They're like 4K or something like that. That's the unit in which you can read from these flash chips physically. So it's not like memory where you can like read a, you know, 32 bytes or 64 bytes. Here we have to read in these bigger chunks. And like physically, like it starts as all ones and you can flip to zero or the other way around. And you can only reset in these large erasure blocks. So it's write once until you erase, and you can only erase in these large blocks, which are many pages. So you can only erase like 256K or more at a time. And that's a major constraint, which obviously makes it hard to use this like a disk. So with a disk, we'd like to be able to overwrite individual, you know, sectors, and maybe 4K is an okay sector size, but if we want to replace a 4K sector, we need to erase the whole block around it, which is going to be like many times that, and overwrite it. And to make things worse, we can only erase each of these blocks order depending on the quality of your flash, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of times. So if you think about our FAT, we want to overwrite that FAT over and over again, you know, probably over 100,000 times if we have over, you know, over a couple years. Flash, if you used it that way, wouldn't work. It would, if you try to keep doing that, it stops working. And what this flash controller is doing is it's going to hide these inconvenient properties about erasure blocks and about not being able to erase more than a certain number of times from the OS. So it's going to make this flash appear kind of like a disk that will be able to write individual blocks, even though that's not physically how these flash chips work. So we'll have our same interface, we'll read and write sectors at a time, we'll have these sector numbers just like on a disk, we'll have a queue of reads and writes, and we need to hide these erasure blocks. And the key idea that these flash controllers use, commonly known as a flash translation layer, because of this trick, is they do block remapping, is that they move where the sectors are in the flash, so when you write to a block, it's just going to locate it to a new place, which they've already erased in advance, so we don't need to worry about erasing a part of the flash which has other data on it. We're going to have some new place for it, and we're going to hide the limit on the number of erasers by making sure we rotate these new places throughout the entire flash so everything gets overwritten roughly the same number of times. So we're gonna overwrite the first part, the second part, the third part, the fourth part, all the way to the end, and wrap around so everything gets overwritten roughly the same number of times. We don't have to worry about hitting this limit, assuming we don't do too many writes in total, versus doing too many writes to one part of our disk, which file systems do all the time, if you think about like the FAT. We're gonna write that millions of times in a typical file system. So basically our flash translation layer conceptually has this mapping table of logical sector numbers to sort of the physical pages of flash. And our physical pages of flash will have the data which is actually referenced by this table. We'll have some unused data where the OS wrote that sector and we moved it somewhere else, but we didn't erase this block yet, so we have some old expired data lying around that we're going to get rid of eventually. And we have some erased parts where, like for this block here, this is an erasure block we're saying, and this bottom part we haven't written yet, so we can write new blocks there, the top part we have, and we have this freshly erased block here when we run out of space there. And we can just append to that whenever the OS writes. So the OS does a read, we just look up where it is in our mapping table, which we're going to have to store in the flash somehow, and do the read to the appropriate part of the flash. And when the OS does a write, we're going to change where the mapping goes and put it at the end of where we're writing. This is a typical structure. There's other ways of organizing this. This is a typical design. So any questions so far? This idea of mapping the data makes sense. And in this way, we can deal with having these big blocks we need to erase all together, and then we can overwrite the individual pieces. So one thing you might say is, well, okay, so we're gonna keep writing here. How do I free this up? You know, when I want to erase that next. And what we're gonna do is that we're gonna say, okay, I want to free up this block for more data because I have a bunch of this gray in here, which is more space I could use. So I'm going to take all the stuff that's still there and I'm going to copy it to where I'm writing. And then I'm going to free up this block. And we can just keep doing that. And this way we're utilizing all the blocks evenly, though we have to do some extra copying as we do that. So this is sort of the basic design that a flash translation layer would use. There's a lot of optimizations and, you know, details I'm not talking about, but this gives you an idea what's going on. And this process here is commonly called garbage collection, because we're sort of removing these gray parts, which are garbage, they're expired data, and making it so we can overwrite those. Yes?
Does like a physical hard disk have something similar to the flash translation layer for like sector remapping?
So the question is, does the physical hard disk have something like the flash translation layer for sector remapping? So I don't know what the structure of sector remapping for hard drives are, but typically hard drives only remap a very small number of sectors. So typically, for the most part, the sectors are where you'd guess they would be by numbering sequentially on the disk. They don't move them around all the time. And this means that the sector remapping for a hard drive can be a very small table, but this is not the case for a flash. So for a hard drive, you only need to remember, you know, the handful of sectors you need to move. For the flash, everything is moving all the time. And finding the space to store this remapping table is actually quite challenging. So, other questions? Okay, so that's our SSDs. And SSDs have better performance. So their reads and writes are typically sub-millisecond. And this is partly because we have this controller which has some RAM. So for reads, the physically reading the flash takes like less than a millisecond. And contiguous blocks don't matter, we don't have to move ahead. So we actually get that performance. Writes are more complicated. So erasing erasure blocks takes like milliseconds, so that's not actually that fast. But we can hide that time by putting your written data in the flash controller's memory while it's waiting to erase blocks. But if you write a lot to flashes, you can have the writes end up being a lot slower, especially if the flash is almost full and we need to be copying lots of data around that isn't what you're writing. So that's SSDs briefly. And a note on future things. So there are a bunch of technologies out there which are new non-volatile memories, which are slower than DRAM and faster than SSDs, and physically have an interface that looks more like normal memory. We can read and write small pieces, but it's persistent. When you lose power, you still have the data, but you can read and write individual like 64-bit values quickly. And no one knows what the equivalent of file systems for these will look like, but it probably shouldn't be the same as what we're doing for hard drives and flash. Okay. So I mentioned that when we think about how these technologies actually work and our data, that scattered this data all over the disk. That we have this metadata in our directory entry, we have all these places in the file allocation table where we need to read these pointers. And if you want to find the location of the kth cluster of the file, you need to read all the previous FAT entries. So you need to like move things a lot on the disk. We can't have just queue a bunch of reads to read a file. We need to scan the FAT to allocate new blocks. So that could mean, you know, we need to look through a lot of entries to find the free ones. And all these things aren't really good for doing nice contiguous or almost contiguous reads and writes, which we learned is how hard drives want to work. So it's not actually as bad in practice. The big reason it's not as bad in practice is that typical real OSs that implement FAT just keep the entire file allocation table in memory, which deals with a bunch of this non-contiguous reads and writes problem. Though obviously it means we're keeping the entire file allocation table in memory and wasting that much memory if we have a giant disk. So I'm going to talk about a different style of file system design, which perhaps has more foresight, or more hindsight than FAT, and was designed with less constraints in mind. So FAT was sort of designed with this idea that it's really good at dealing with really constrained environments. So if you want a file system you can implement with like 4K of memory, FAT is probably your choice. And the file system I'm talking about here are things that were used for Unix, where we assume we have like that page cache. We're going to start out with a typical example of a simple version of this, the file system that XV6 implements, which is a typical Unix-like file system, which is a bit better at doing contiguous reads, has some other features, and has some different names. So XV6 calls the parts and things that divides the disk into blocks instead of clusters, but the words mean the same thing. And it separates out the data into separate tables, unlike having this big FAT which does everything. So here's the XV6 disk layout. We have our boot block. This is where we keep the information to boot the OS, or we keep it blank if we can't boot from this disk. We have a super block. This is our equivalent of the disk header, of the file system header. We have a log we'll talk about probably next time. We have an inode array. Inodes are what are going to represent the information about a particular file. We have a free block map, and we have the actual data. So first thing, as I said, was the super block. So the super block is the header, and the super block tells us where to find all this stuff. Just like with FAT, the super block tells us where to find the actual file allocation table, or that super block, the header. Here, the super block is the header, which tells us where to find the log, the inode array, the free block map, and all these parts of the disk. So the inode array contains information about each file. So this is just an array. Each file has an index into the array. And rather than our directory entries telling us where the file's data starts and its size, they just point to an index into this array, and that has all the information about the file in one place. So this means that when we open a file, we just need to remember where it is in this array. We don't need to remember its directory entry and also its FAT tables. So this contains the file type in XV6. So is it a directory or a normal file? Like the attribute bin in FAT. But rather than being in the directory entry, we have a separate data structure that stores this for every file. It contains information for this device file type. So remember I talked about devices? These are actual files in the file system in XV6. They just have, rather than storing data, they store a number to tell us which device driver to use if you access this instead of accessing the disk for read. We have a link count. So the link count is the number of times, number of uses in directories. So it's the number of times directories refer to this file. So typically it's one. We'll learn that we can have more than one, too. We have its size in bytes, and we have this array of addresses, which is the locations of the data block. So rather than having a linked list of locations, we have an array. That means if we want to find out where the 2000th byte of the file is, we can figure out what index into the array is the block which contains that and find it that way rather than traversing a linked list. You might say, doesn't that limit our file size? We'll get to that later. But most simply, like adders of 0 is 11, that means disk block 11 is where the first block of this is stored. So we also have a free block map. This is where we store information about what data blocks are used. So rather than scanning the list of all blocks, we in the inodes, but like we could like see is this not this block number used in any inode. We scan this map, which just has one bit per data block, indicating whether it's used. So it's stored very compactly, and this is how we find free blocks. So we still have to scan the whole thing, but at least it's stored in the most compact way possible, so we have the most compact possible representation and least reading from disk to find things. And we have free inodes, too. We need to find inode entries. The way this works in XV6 is that free inodes have a type of 0. So this field, this first field up here, there's a special value for, you know, free equals 0 for here. And that's how we find allocate new inodes. So XV6 directories are similar to what we saw in FAT, but rather than storing all the file metadata, we learned that that's stored in the inode array, so we just have an index into the inode array, which is this is I number here. And another name that you'll see used in Unix for directory entries is a hard link. So it's a link to a particular file. We'll call it a hard link to distinguish it from something we'll call soft links. And unlike in FAT, we can have multiple hard links to a file. So multiple directories can refer to the same file by just having directory entries with the same number. So we need to allocate new blocks and inodes. XV6's solution is we have these, we have a free block map, which is just a bitmap, or we have the actual inode table, which tells us when we look at each inode, we can look at its type to see if it's free. We just do a linear search, find the first one, use it. So that's the XV6 file system. So it's in some ways nicer than FAT, in some ways perhaps not. And this is typical of Unix-like file system designs that you'll see in pretty much any modern Unix-like system. So there's three things I haven't talked about. So one is, what's that log I showed you? We'll talk about that on Thursday. The other is the adders array. So that's where we find the data blocks. How big is that? What if I want a big file? What if I want a small file? How does that work? So we'll talk about that next. Also, there's an issue of other file metadata. XV6 just doesn't have it. But on Unix-like file systems, which do, we just add more fields to the inode. You want a modification time? Put it in the inode. in addition to the size. And so. So XV6 data blocks, you might say, there's 13 of them, how do we store anything? So their solution is that some of the entries of this array of data blocks work differently. So the first 12 are actually pointers to data blocks. So they're the number of the actual data of the file. The last one is an indirect pointer. So it points to a block, but rather than that block containing file data, it just contains an array of more block pointers. So our file's data has the block for adders 11, immediately followed by the first thing in this indirect block, the second thing in this indirect block, the third thing in this indirect block, and so on. Those are our data that makes up the file. And given this, we can make the files be much larger than just 13 blocks. So how much larger is a good question. So XV6, we have 512 byte blocks, 2 byte block pointers. So we have 256 block pointers in that indirect block. 256 blocks is 256K. And so our maximum file can store about 6K plus 256K. So that's a lot bigger than you might have been worried about from seeing an array of size 13, but that sure is not actually great. You're probably used to your file system supporting like gigabytes, and we aren't close. But an extension of this strategy is used by many file systems to support files which are around a gigabyte. So I'll give an example of Linux's extended two file system, which is a similar design, but has the extra features you'd expect in a modern system. So for example, this is the Linux extended two inode, copied from the Linux kernel. This funny type here is a 16-bit little endian value. So we have the file mode, which is where the type is stored. We have some other information like modification times and the user which owns the file and so on. And we also have another block array. So this is basically the same as adders. But they use a scheme like that, but they have more indirection. So the way it works in extended 2 is it starts out the same as XV6. So we have 12 pointers to the first 12 data blocks. Then we have an indirect pointer to the next block of pointers. Then we have this double indirect pointer. So if the first indirect block wasn't enough space, we have a pointer to a block of more pointers, more indirect block pointers to the actual blocks, to blocks of more block pointers. And we have a triple indirect pointer. So we have, so we have our first 12 direct, and then we have an indirect which points to the next block, and then we have a double indirect, which points to more indirect blocks. And if that's still not enough, we have a triple indirect, which does this with yet another layer. And a nice thing about this scheme is that small files, we have mostly direct pointers. And large files, we have all this extra indirection, so we only really pay an extra cost for being able to support these gigabyte files for the gigabyte files. For the small files, we're just storing everything in the inode that is in one place. For the large files, we might have to look at all sorts of places on disk to find out where it's stored, but we're only doing that when the file's already pretty big and it's going to take a while to read anyways. So if we have 1K blocks, and let's say our block pointers are 4 bytes, how big can a file be? So we have 4 byte block numbers. We have 12 direct ones. So this 12 direct ones is going to be 12K of data pointed to. Our indirect one, so how many pointers can we store in 1 block? So this is our, we have our, this is this pointer here, which stores an array of pointers to the actual data blocks. How many fit in that 1K block? So this is a 1K block. How many pointers fit in there? They're 4 bytes each. What, sorry? 256. Yeah. So 256 pointer, 256 block numbers times 1K. So that one indirect block, so that's 256K. This is the same as we, And then we have a double indirect pointer. So with a double indirect pointer, we have a pointer to a block, which has pointers to each of these blocks, which do reference 256K of stuff. And we have that times 256. So here we have 256 squared K. And by a similar reasoning, we're going to have 256 cubed K here about. Assuming I didn't mess up calculations. So this can support, so these extra pointers can support quite large files because 256 cubed is not small. And this is what the most common scheme that Unix-like file systems used for a long time. There's another scheme we'll probably talk about eventually. So any questions on this? So another thing that this scheme allows, besides making it easy to find a particular block of a file and making it so we have like a contiguous array for small files and not for large ones, is it allows this idea of sparse files. So for example, if you open a file, seek to the middle of it and write some data, this will be what is known as a sparse file. So its blocks will look something like this. That most of its block pointers will point to nothing, you know, but we'll have some scattered ones wherever you actually wrote will have some data, depending on where you wrote to the file. So this is something that we can do in this style of file system, that we can just only store the parts of the file that actually have data. Whether that's useful or not, depends who you ask. But it's a sort of a naturally supported feature. So questions on sparse files? So I mentioned that we call directory entries hard links. That directories can have, files can have multiple hard links. So let me show you what that can look like. So here, I create a file test.txt. I use the ln command, and this is the sort of POSIX link function. And that links makes new.txt a new link to the same file as test.txt. So now we have 2 directory entries. So we have our directory here contains, you know, test.txt with inum equals like 1000. This is the index into the inode array, and it also now has new.text with inum equals 1000. This means if we write something to replace what's in new.text, they're the same file, they're the same inode. We're going to edit the blocks in inumber 1000. So we have this, these both point to the same inode, and we have the same adder zero. So this echo will operate that adder zero, and it affects both of the file names. And in this example, I did it in the same directory, but this would work across directories too. But if I ln, instead of doing ln to new.text, I could do ln test.text to, you know, other dir new.text, and we have the same sort of share file. So this makes sense. And one thing you might worry about is, how do we actually make this, you know, get rid of the file at the right time? So that's why we have that link count. So we track the number of links. When it goes down to zero, we delete the file. Exactly the same thing you were supposed to do for copy and write, but for files. And Unix typically uses this trick where we also count open files as a sort of link. And this means that there's this trick you might see used on Unix-like systems where you create a file, open it, and delete it while we have it open. And this is a way of making a temporary file. Because having it open counts as a link, it won't be deleted as long as we have it open, but it doesn't have a name anymore. Because there's no way of finding it in a directory entry, but it will be kept around until we close it. And either close it by hand or process exits and we don't have it open anymore. And because we call these files links, this means that the rm command actually calls the unlink command, unlink function, which removes a link. And I mentioned hard links. So you might say, what are soft links? What are not hard links? These are called soft or symbolic links, and these reference a file by name. So this is a directory entry, which you can see on ls-l. It contains, what it actually contains is the file name. So rather than having an inode, we have in the directory entry, we have new.text is a pointer to the string test.txt. It like contains literally the string where our test.txt just said the I number was inode 1000. And this means that, for example, if we, as in this example, remove test.txt, new.txt gives us no such file or directory. That the system says, oh, it's a pointer to this name, let me try to find that name. Oh, doesn't exist. And if we create a complete new file with that name, it will notice it. So questions on symbolic links? Yeah.
So is the name just like, is it going to be the full path to the same directory?
So the question is, what name is actually stored? The way it works is it's literally storing this string. So if I typed a full path there, it would store a full path. If I type just test.txt, it just stores test.txt. And it's interpreted as relevant to the current thing. But you could store like a full path, and that would be something different. So this is, I went over sort of the XV6 file system. I talked about how to fix one of its problems, which was that it didn't support very large files, and we just did more indirection. Let's talk about some other issues. So one was that our inode and block map data is stored pretty far away from the file data. So at least we have all the data for a file together. We don't like have to read the directory entry and the fat. But it's not much better because the inode array is near the beginning of the disk. Who knows where our file is? We're going to be seeking a lot. We'd like to avoid that on a hard drive. Choosing the first free block or inode is kind of inconvenient because it means that if we like append to a file, we're going to tend to have the appended data be really far away from the earlier data, most likely. And we're going to have like blocks scattered all over a disk. That's not going to be efficient for reading. We'd like to have them together. And also, we'd like to deal with block size. So our blocks are pretty small, which means we have a lot of space for metadata. Like, we have 512 byte blocks, so we have 2 bytes for every 512 bytes just to store where things are, and more extra space when we have these indirect pointers where we have to store a pointer to the pointers, or if we learned about, you know, double or triple pointers to pointers to pointers. And we also, we're doing directory entries the same way as FAT, where we're just going to have an array of directory entries, and we have to scan the whole thing to find a directory by name. Maybe there's a better way where if we have a directory of like 10,000 files, we don't have to read, you know, 5,000 directory entries to find our file. So I'm going to start by talking about FFS, the Berkeley Fast File System, which solves some of these problems. And this is really what Linux's Extended 2 is based on, and I believe BSD's UFS, which is might be what OS X bases some other things on. And it solves some of these problems. In particular, it has a nice, relatively simple solution to this first problem, which is that our inode data is stored far away, and we sometimes allocate a file blocks all over the disk. So we're doing lots of extra seeking, both to go from reading the inode to reading the actual data for the file, and for reading different parts of the data for the file, because we're just using whatever blocks happen to be freed up anywhere on the disk. And the solution FFS had is that we have these block groups, sometimes called cluster cylinder groups. And basically, we store a free map and an inode array for the whole file system, for each group, along with a bunch of data. So you can think of each of these as sort of a mini file system. We have our free map and our inode array and our actual data. That's most of the file system. We have a common header for all of these. But we sort of divided up in these mini file systems. And the idea is that typically a file is going to be within exactly one of these mini file systems. And a directory is going to be in exactly one of these mini file systems, so we'll have things close together on the disk. Like, we'll still be seeking around, but we'll be seeking around within this small space, so it should be a lot faster. And it's still going to be one file system, so we'll just divide up the inode numbers and the block numbers among the different parts, among these different groups. And this means, notably, that if we have a really, really big file, like here, its inode can point to blocks over here if we need to. We'll try to have it point to blocks in its grok group, but if we run out of space, no problem. We can still have pointers to other grok groups. And our idea is that most of the data for each directory will be in a block group. And the way we'll do this is that when we write a directory, a file in a directory, we'll put it in the same block group as the directory. When we write a new directory, we'll find a new block group for it. And as I said, large files, we might split up. For small files, the allocation strategy that FFS used is that it allocated the blocks in order within the group. So it tried to find space in the particular block group that the file belonged in, and it just took the first block. And the intuition as to why this isn't really bad is that typically we have a few little scatter free spaces near the beginning of the data segment for the block group, and then a big run at the end if we're allocating a large file. So typically we'll not have too many big gaps. And it's still going to be close to the inode and the directory entry. So questions on this idea of block groups? So this is a remarkably simple scheme to try to keep files kind of adjacent on disk. Not exactly adjacent, but pretty close. And it works pretty well. A notable thing about making these block groups work well with this allocation policy is that a choice that FFS made is, oh, disks are big. We're just going to say you need to have like 10% of your space free or things are going to work badly. Because you need, for this sort of thing to happen, you need a bunch of free space, but their assumption is just, we're just going to tell you to keep that space free. So we'll finish up next time with talking about dealing with small files, and then move on to reliability.